This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Rack Addicts After Hours, episode 69. Maybe we'll get to 96 one day, but it's going to be good when we do. I'm joined by Pete and Luke, so it's going to be a lovely, lovely evening down in the basement where I'm hiding. We've actually got some anniversaries this week to chat about. We'll get to that later. One I'm more excited for than the other, to be honest. But like I said, we'll get into that. Weekly update time, as always, that's where we start. Luke, what have you been a-doing?
Well, I realised that last week I was remiss to not have mentioned a shameless self-plug. So I thought I'd bring that out for this week, if I may. Borrow our listeners' ears for a moment to inform them that the original Gravy Base mixtape, recorded and released in 2015, is now back up on Spotify. It has been re-released. This is the first album of my band, Birdsworth. This was all done before I was even thought of or part of the band process, but it's something that some of our fans have requested goes back up online. And we have now done that. So it is the Gravy Base mixtape, the original version.
Lovely stuff. Why did it disappear from the airwaves and people's Spotify playlists?
Well, part of that was just because we wanted to put more attention on the Volume 2 coming out.
Mm.
It was a little bit of also the fact that the artistic direction was very different. We decided to take a sort of break between the two so as to give the Volume 2 version a bit more breathing room and make it its own thing. The atmosphere between the two records is quite a bit different. The mixtape Volume 1 is a bit more somber. It has some songs that are more focused on love and relationships and things like that, whereas the mixtape Volume 2 is kind of a party record. It's where we want Gravy Base to be now. So I think that was part of it, just to kind of make the difference in terms of, or just to kind of craft Gravy Base as a genre to be something more exciting. But as we joked, due to unpopular demand, it has come back because we have been petitioned to put it up. And well, actually, I'm quite glad to see it. So that's it, really. We just wanted to get the complete collection out there for all potential people's listening pleasure.
Lovely stuff. I think we've had the story before, potentially one of your earlier appearances on the podcast, but why and what Gravy Base? Yes. Questions without proper sentence structure.
Well, it sounds like one of my answers. Well,
far away.
Where to start with that one? So Gravy Base is one of those things where it's actually quite hard to talk about. The origin of the term is very secret. It's very difficult to describe the revelation that came to our Jack Coffee in words that humans could understand, to be perfectly frank. It's not something I've ever asked him about. It's something that I've seen other people ask him about, and he either breaks down in tears or flies into a rage at the inability to express how the inspiration came to him. But I think it had something to do with somebody calling him and saying it sounds like gravy. I'm not sure. I wasn't there.
Well, I'm a big fan of gravy. Yeah, at a family dinner, the gravy boat does have to pass everybody else before it gets to me, because I do prefer a soupy delivery. I will go for the Yorkshire pudding with the gravy in there for optimum coating of the vegetables when you dip them in.
Okay, so the Yorkshire pudding becomes a sort of gravy receptacle on the plate.
A secondary gravy boat. A gravy lifeboat, if you will.
Nice.
There we are, Gravy Base. Looking forward to taking a listen, because I've only really heard one of your tunes, I think. Yeah, is that the one that had a YouTube video come out not recently anymore, because time is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
Lunchtime doubly so, that's a reference for later in the podcast. But the one that was in a car park.
Oh, in a car park?
Let me just do a quick Google on the old YouTube. Google on the... What am I? Disgusting.
It starts anyway. In a car park. I can think of... Ah, no, I know which one you mean. Rendezvous.
Yes, of course, with the fun spelling.
Yes. Rendezvous came out last year. The video came out, I think. Off the top of my head, that's really bad. I'm in the band. But I was present for the filming and creation of that song.
Oh, yes, there we go. A year ago, Rendezvous. That's the chap I know. I have a question for you, Pete.
Yes.
What have you been up to this week?
Other than enjoying the wonderful weather that British climate has decided to serve up for once. I mean, having said that, this time last year was very good, but last week we had some very strange weather, didn't we? We had the sunshine followed by the snow and so forth, but it seems to have settled down into more spring-like weather. And to that note, I have been considering how we move forward in respect to playing live. And it's something we've discussed many times, because the first method would be to do it outdoors. In fact, everything is...
Yes, I think
this is going to be a very alfresco year for everything.
Well, it makes it sound so much more appealing.
Yes. So I am prepping for that possibility. I have been doing more research. We did a little bit last year, but I've been doing much more research in respect to these... I don't want to say leisure battery, because now that I've done the research, a leisure battery is normally a kind of large lead acid battery that goes in a caravan rather than one of these sort of
something a bit more high tech with USB ports and such.
Whereas these other, you call them travel batteries, I suppose. I don't know what the right description is.
Yeah, they're more of an offshoot of the little portable battery bank.
Yeah, sort of bricks, power bricks or something like that, but on a larger scale. They typically have a 13 amp socket, and they'll have a couple of 5 volt USB outlets and a 12 volt as well, and they'll be highly regulated and so forth. I've done some research in respect to what's available, and again, Amazon is our friend, and there's quite a few products that they have at hand. And I've also need to do some calculations about how much current my equipment will draw, so I can work out the amp hours and so forth and see what is the most appropriate battery for...
Is this for your evil scheme of going the Roadcaster route in the future?
Well, that as well. That'll be one use. I want to get multiple uses out of it. I tend to buy specialist equipment and find that I just use it for one thing once a year. it'd be for the Roadcaster for outside podcasting, although we have facilities for that anyway, but also for performance.
Yeah.
Enough to power the Wave State or... maybe my large array of pedals and small sound creation devices that I have strapped to that large pedal board.
Our outdoor modcaf did work quite well, so it'd be great to do one again.
I have the Bose S1 Pro, so they are self-powering. Mm-hmm. So that PA side of things is dealt with. So it's just having a suitable amount of power to hand to power any electronic instruments I intend to bring with me. So I was going to ask, is there any plans for the modcaf to do any outside performances or
the difficulty events? Is the lack of any brain space or time for any of us three to actually organize, plan and anything. We've been doing our little Zoom things. We do need to wait and see what happens with the West End Centre and whether it survives and if we can still piggyback off that comedy night, what their capacity might be. But the outdoor one worked so well. I mean, why not? One of our members did suggest a rave in a tunnel under the A3, which would be fun in one way.
I wouldn't fancy the £10,000 fine. I see that a particular rapper got fined at the weekend for doing an outdoor event in Manchester, I want to say.
Yeah, well, we wouldn't be contravening any, you know, COVID restrictions. That's not in our... It's not something we want to do, but we just want to get our community back together and seeing people again.
Yeah, it's a social thing.
Absolutely. It's good enough on the internet, but we have had some people who are experts in the online jamming with a program called Jamtaba, and it works. Yeah, that's about it. It works. It's not entirely pleasurable. I think it is quite impressive. It's sort of a plug-in that you'll have on both systems and various time code things. It will sync up so one person will be a full cycle out. So that might be a bar with 32 divisions in it behind the other person. So you can still kind of do stuff and it'll sync up for listening back to it. It's all about real time though.
Yeah. Ironically, in some respects, I had a customer inquiry this last weekend gone while I was in the store. I took a phone call from a gentleman that was asking how he may power his digital piano if he was out and about.
Oh, yeah.
And I was able to unload on him straight away more information than he was expecting. So I gave him the full rundown and gave him several options and told him exactly where to buy them and how much it would cost him. So I took him through the petrol powered generator with an inverter, which is key, so that you get ultra smooth power.
Of course.
And also the travel battery option, which is the one that he seemed to like. Because I already have the generator, which I could use, and it's quite, I would say, reasonably quiet for something with a small combustion engine in it, especially if you sort of have it on a long extension lead away from yourself.
Yeah.
It sort of putts in the background. And it's all sort of encased. It's just like a sort of big plastic briefcase type of thing.
Yeah, you wouldn't, if it was a modcaf anyway, you wouldn't need to worry about generators. We have access to 7 kilowatts, I think, of generator.
How
big
is that?
We're all good on that. It's a large fridge kind of size, but not like a tall fridge, like a big one unit fridge thing.
And did you use that last year? Or
no, we didn't actually use a generator last year. We didn't need one. This is for the company's, our live stream stuff. So we have a UPS on the full system, and when that goes, somebody legs it upstairs, fires up the diesel generator, and we'll keep going.
Doesn't sound very portable.
It also doesn't sound very climate friendly, which is funny considering the live streams we're doing anyway.
Yeah, so I'm getting close to being somewhat able to perform in an environment where there's no electricity.
Mm.
So whenever you decide that you're going to have a modcaf event or something of that ilk,
we'll let you know.
I can come along and make some strange bleeps and noises, or maybe that's something a want. Bit more melodious.
Well, as I've said countless times, I really, really loved the last one you did at a modcaf. I'm sure it will be a delight, whatever it might be. I said earlier we had some anniversaries to celebrate. This one isn't a particular, well, actually neither of them are to the day, but this year is the 42nd anniversary of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yay! And the reason I'm thinking about it today is I got an email notification of a certain product that has been dispatched. Do either of you know Chris Riddell?
It rings a bell, as most things
do. He does some political cartoons, but mostly he's an illustrator for books, lots of children's books and young adult fiction and things. My favourite being The Edge Chronicles, which is a Paul Stewart thing, which you may have come across.
I know that.
Really distinctive style. Impossible to describe over the medium of spoken word, but just do a quick Google. I'm sure you'll recognise it. Either way, he's illustrated Hitchhiker's Guide and that for the anniversary, and that is on its way to me, and I'm so very excited. It's going to be a good one. My sister and I pre-ordered our copies a long time ago.
Originally, it is a Radio 4, I don't know if you want to say play, but it was definitely a script before it was a book.
Really?
I don't know if it was a book before it was a TV series.
Because I've definitely heard the BBC reading, I guess, of it, and that's brilliant, brilliant fun.
And also there's been subsequently a lot of sequels, and not all of them have been written by Douglas Adams because obviously he passed away prematurely.
The trilogy of five, I think, are all Douglas Adams. And then And Another Thing is Owen Colfer. I think And Another Thing was the first non-Douglas Adams one.
So when you said 47 years, are we saying 1975? 42
years.
40. Oh, yeah. I certainly remember listening to it the first time round on the radio, but I also remember the TV series, which was in the 80s.
Yeah, I didn't catch any of that. I definitely saw the film, which was fine.
No, I think the film was okay. It captured the essence of it quite well.
Oh, yeah, of course. And there's apparently a series coming out in 2022, which I'll probably ignore.
They recently did the Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Yes, with Elijah Wood. Did you watch any of it?
I did. Yeah, I quite liked it.
Yeah, I never read any of the books. I didn't get into the series much.
I haven't read the full Dirk Gently series. I have read the first book, but it was a very long time ago, about 10 years ago. And I can't remember it verbatim. But I do remember watching the show and thinking, and then later reading up, that it is a fair departure from Douglas Adams's original story and plot. But
okay.
I think it adds to it in a nice way. Certainly the cinematography is absolutely fantastic. It's one of the better produced TV series that I've seen come from Netflix in quite a long time. As a purely a feast for the eyes, rather than a faithful adaptation, it's worth a watch.
They do have some quite fantastic titles. So from the Dirk Gently series, The Salmon of Doubt is fantastic. And one of my favourites, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul.
I feel like I've had quite a few of those after a few too many teas or bevies.
Oh, it is great. It is great. Also some good audiobooks. Stephen Fry has read Hitchhiker's Guide, and then the second one, whose title I've totally forgotten, is Martin Freeman, and he's actually really good on audiobooks. I hadn't heard anything before. good stuff. That was just that little teaser for the anniversary. Anyway, let's move on a smidge. I mentioned last week that I had borrowed an Empress Zoya. I haven't felt like opening the manual and digging into it because that's what I do every weekend for other people, and it's miserable. But I'm pleased to report that it's actually quite intuitive so far, at least. You've got a little scroll thing to choose what module you want. You press one of the squares and press the other one, and it kind of links them together. So I've made a simple subtractive synth sound. I've used it as a reverb pedal, and I haven't dug in any further. But I haven't had any headaches. So I haven't plumbed it yet, but it hasn't driven me insane, at least.
Other than that, what's your general opinion as a product? There was a lot of, I wouldn't say hysteria, but there was a lot of excitement when it was first released.
The buttons are quite tall and squishy.
Okay.
Which isn't that great for wanting to try and do anything quickly, and it doesn't promote that feeling of, oh, I have done the thing I tried to do. You sort of squish it and go, yeah. So that's not amazing. Sound quality is fine so far. I haven't had any complaints, nor have I been wowed by it. There's MIDI, and there isn't a headphone thing. That would be nice if there was a headphone jack.
But it's essentially a guitar pedal, is it not?
Yeah, it's in that format, and it has lots of tools for doing such a thing. I think if I were to go and purchase one, I would wait for the Eurorack version, because it has useful things like attenuators and sort of some ins and outs that would be a little bit more useful.
I think the Eurorack version makes more sense.
Indeed.
But having said that, I think it's a bit
spenny,
dense as a product, yeah, with all those buttons.
It is. And I've said so many times before, I hate menus. And then I'm looking at this thing that has a menu and it's all, I don't know. I will report back if my opinions change.
How do you use the control surface, all those buttons? I mean, how's it set up?
So they work as a grid. Think a lot of those, you know, visual node-based programming languages where you kind of drag a box that might be a logic thing. You know, you have some of those if this, then that type bits where you just drag blocks around and connect wires between them. It's that kind of idea on the grid. And you can just click on a button and you have the menu and the scrolly wheely bit in the top left. That's how you navigate through and pick effects like reverbs and the more obviously guitar stuff or an oscillator or a filter. And you can kind of, like as I mentioned earlier, you hold one block, tap on the other one, it will join them with a virtual cable.
Oh, I see. It doesn't sound very intuitive.
It is, actually.
Okay.
It makes a lot of sense. Just imagine if you had a load of guitar pedals. You'd just pop one there, plug a cable from that into the other one. It's okay. Just doing it that way. It makes sense. Things like reverbs that have a lot of controls sort of take up a lot of those little squares. So they might be 7 wide, so they keep sort of wrapping over to the next row, and it's a bit confusing. And if you click on each of the squares, you'll get the different option like mix, time, filters and stuff.
If you weren't able to borrow one, let's say, would you consider purchasing one?
Absolutely not.
I thought you'd say that.
As our colleague Dave told me, there are some people making some incredible stuff for it, and it's very powerful, but there aren't many people doing that.
There are always those who are prepared to dive into a very esoteric piece of equipment.
And be that one well-known person on a forum that everyone goes, oh, the Lord of the Zoya.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That kind of thing.
Exactly.
So it's kind of okay, but updates will follow. Let's jump into some actual news of the synth variety that we've been scrambling for. We've been desperate for some kind of news for weeks. Let's go first to the other anniversary, which is the OP1 from Teenage Engineering, 10 years old.
Mm.
I wouldn't have really thought that at all. I didn't know it had been around that long.
I think we, way back in one of the podcasts, we had a quick look as we were talking about it.
That rings a bell.
And then you were quite shocked at the time. Cause,
yeah, I'm still shocked again because I keep forgetting
well,
things.
Well, it's a piece of equipment that I'm sure it's had some firmware updates, but essentially it's the same thing 10 years later, which is quite novel, yeah, really, for a digital piece of equipment. Normally the technology moves on quite briskly.
It's certainly impressive. I think a lot of that is, of course, down to really well thought out engineering in the physicality of the device and such. It's not necessarily an appealing interface in some ways, but it's playful and strange, and that really high quality screen does do a lot for it, even though it's kind of tiny.
We used one on the Mixtape Volume 2. Eddie has an OP1. I have had a play with it a few times, but and especially with that very interesting display you mentioned, the way it gets laid out in very esoteric ways depending on how you're using the device is so cool. But to a synth novice like me, it's completely impenetrable. But Ed uses it with absolute aplomb. There's a few, I don't know if I could remember off the top of my head, and perhaps I shouldn't reveal them for the sake of letting people pick Easter eggs out, but it does appear, I think, twice if not three times on the Mixtape Volume 2. And it's just a wonderful noise. It just, the things it does are really, really cool.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to use the E word, but as somebody who's quite familiar with synthesizers, it's not intuitive at all. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
So it's another one you just have to sit with until you figure out its little internal logic, and then it will open up for you.
And it's just dripping with functionality. It's not just a synth, it's a sampler, it's a recorder, it's a whole studio, really, in a little
Definitely.
Package. On the occasions I've had to test them, invariably when they've been returned with allegedly having a fault or so forth, I've managed to sort of generically go over them and just ensure they're working or look at the area that's supposed to be not functioning. But on the whole, I've found them very obtruse.
Yeah, I think it's the same for the OPZ as well. You just have to sit with it, especially with the OPZ, no screen. You're working with nothing. It's so tricky.
It's that sort of avant-garde digital technology, isn't it? They want to have the aesthetic of an older synthesizer with modern technology. It's very cool, but it is impenetrable for a beginner.
Yeah, as a brand, I think they're quite committed to a bit of that impenetrability.
Yeah.
And putting the industrial design potentially a little bit higher on their priorities list than it might need to be for a musical instrument, a tool, but with good results all the time.
A certain amount of form over function.
Yes.
I perused their website earlier today. I was actually looking for another product which I thought they had released recently, which is a summing mixer for their pocket operator range.
Oh yeah, I hadn't heard of that.
I couldn't even find their pocket operator range on their website. I did find a couple of pocket operators, but they're ones associated with, I think it was Capcom, you know, the games.
Yeah, people. They had a Street Fighter edition, I think.
Yeah, there was two, the Street Fighter and another game.
Mm.
But I could not find the standard range of pocket operators, nor the summing mixer, or the modular, the yellow modular thing.
Yeah, I'm on the website now. Very pretty. Here we go. You click on products, and it shows you a different selection of products every time. What?
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, and there's lots of sliding graphics and all sorts of whizzy.
Okay, this one is their collaboration with somebody else, which looks kind of like a Game Boy with a reel from a fishing rod on one side. Then, oh yeah, they have an instant camera, like a Polaroid camera. I forgot about that.
The floor speakers.
Yeah, those are kind of cool because they revived a vintage design. Hadn't had to attempt to test one at work once, but it's not going to happen. Oh, here we go. Here's the pocket operator
range. That was a pair of speakers going to LA. I attempted to test the second one without realizing you'd already attempted the first one and fell
and
into the
bravely
same...
bravely given up.
Yeah, it fell into the same problems. The novelty of just unwrapping it was a challenge.
Oh, it gosh. Was.
It, as much design that. Has gone into the packaging as into the product.
Which I'm fine with, considering what teenage engineering charge, but it's not ideal for your specific need, having to test it.
Well, we're talking about a individual floor speaker that costs the best part of £1,000.
Yeah.
But it has the word, was it like orthodirectional or something in the title, so you know it's good.
Oh, yes. Was Teenage Engineering the company some time ago? We did a podcast and the topic of a sort of portable radio came up and we all balked at the price.
I saw the radio today as well. That was the other thing I saw.
Oh, what, a real one?
Yeah, the radio, it had a funny name. It's on the website if you're on it now.
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen one in the flesh. I just saw it on the website.
The OB4. That's very
interesting. Yeah, that's what I thought. Is that another instrument? Oh, no, it's a radio.
They call it the magic radio.
Yeah, but what's magic about it?
Who knows?
It can disappear a lot of funds from your wallet very quickly.
And what was the price again? Can you remind
us? Oh, it was like 800 quid or something horrible. Let me have a look. 600. That's still horrible.
And is
anyway.
It digital radio, analog radio? I mean,
FM.
It's an FM radio for right
with Bluetooth.
Okay.
And infinite recording and a weird looping thing that nobody asked
What's
for.
What's infinite recording?
Nobody asked for this anyway.
What is infinite recording when it's at home?
Where's the thing? So it has an endless looping tape. Think the buffer on immutable clouds, for example. So it's just constantly recording and will keep a so many seconds backlog of whatever was played through it. And you can sort of rewind it and loop it because you can.
Okay.
Is this the kind of thing?
This is so you can rewind radio, basically.
Maybe.
I thought maybe perhaps it might be geared towards if you had like an OP1, you could sample from the radio, load it into the OP1, but then the OP1 you can just sample directly onto anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's for linking all the toys together either. It's kind of a standalone weird one.
Yeah, we've done this anyway. It's strange.
I wonder how many of those they've sold or sell.
Very good question.
I would imagine the answer is disappointingly quite a lot.
I think you're right, Luke, unfortunately. But yeah, 10 years of OP1. It's pretty cool. It's very expensive. It's more expensive than it was. Congratulations to Teenage Engineering, because it is cool. Next bit of news. Pete, do you want to take this one? We got an Erica Synths something for us.
Yes, Erica Synths have released three new modules, two of which are filters. And I believe the third one is a way of unifying the filters, as one is a high-pass filter and one's a low-pass filter. And the third one is the filter coupler.
Yes.
So it's a satellite module to the black high-pass filter and the black low-pass filter, and adds bandpass. So I quite like bandpass as an effect or as a tool.
Yeah, it can be quite nice. Get some movement.
Especially if you modulate it.
Yeah, if you play with the resonance, you can get some really cool kind of nasal weirdnesses happening.
So I rarely get excited about anything Eurorack these days. I mean, occasionally I will, and then I'll get unexcited when I find out that I'm going to wait 6 months or 9 months for it, or indefinitely sometimes. So I tend to not get too overawed. I wonder if they'll be available as kits, because a lot of their products aren't they available through Thonk?
Yeah, they've stopped doing that now, I think.
Okay.
You might still be able to get PCBs and things from places, but they kind of moved away from that. That kit bit a while ago. Don't know why.
I'm sure they're, you know, nice, good quality. They do go on about in their literature how good the quality of these are. And there's nothing too unusual about these filters. They're pretty standard configurations and so forth. Yeah, they're reasonably priced. So approximately, I had to do a bit of translation from euros, and I had a look at a couple of European retailers. I couldn't find anyone in the UK that was listing these or giving a price at the moment. So my sort of ballpark figure of the cost in UK pounds is £150 per filter and £90 for the coupler.
It's not bad. I like it when they're slightly more in the guitar pedal region of things rather than the big guitar pedal, like the Strymans, the big Strymans and things.
Yeah.
Nicer in the more affordable end.
£500 Eurorack module, or even more expensive.
Yep.
Or if you're talking about a Swaiman, £1,000 filter.
Yep.
Gosh.
Did I say that the Schwaman prices have rocketed after Wawa's unfortunate demise?
Let me quickly pull one up. David from the ModCaf, who's one of our listeners, and thank you, of course, for your listening, David. He posted a link to the ModCaf Facebook group a while ago of this. I'm going to see if I can find it, because it was absolutely shocking. Pete, what do you think would be the most ridiculous Schwaman thing to jump in price that would make you the most angry? Place your votes.
Well, it's difficult to say. The resonator, which is quite expensive.
Guess again.
So go to the other extreme, the S1.
It's pretty small.
Okay, pretty small.
We're not talking like merchandise, are we?
No. Well, actually.
Did Swayman do patch leads? I can't. No.
No. It's a blank panel.
Okay, yeah. I can see that. One HP blank panel, or two HP, rather.
I think this is two. So, Luke, this is just literally, it's a bit of aluminium with two holes in it.
Okay.
In the in Schwaman grey,
yeah.
Place your bets. Bearing in mind, this might be a fiver or less from everybody
quid.
Else. No.
Are we saying higher or lower?
We're higher.
Jeez. I almost broke our embargo then. I would say, I'll go 60, 65.
Pete?
100. I'll see you at 65.
And... £102.66.
Wow.
And £34 shipping.
Is that actually new or secondhand?
Secondhand on Reverb.
You can own your own piece of Schwaben.
Do you know, that's about 1/6 the price of a new graphics card.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. And it's just a bit of metal.
It's about, I don't know, 10 pence worth of aluminium.
That's crazy.
With a bit of paint on it. I mean, it has jumped. As I say, the S1s were going for roughly about £4,000, and now they've suddenly at about £7,000 to £8,000, yeah, within the space of a couple of months.
Yeah. Scalpers at it again. Mm-hmm. While we're thinking of actually Erica Synths, we were thinking of Erica Synths, of all of the modules I DIY'd, which is probably more than 30, the only one that didn't work in some capacity was an Erica Synths envelope generator. Not for the fault of Erica Synths, it must have been me doing something, but never rescued that one. But no, their stuff is pretty
great.
Do
you still have it?
No, it's all gone. I don't know what... Actually, no, I farmed that for spare bits.
Okay.
I think. So it slowly disintegrated, and then I think I just chucked the panel.
That's a shame. It could have been rescued.
It probably could have been before I just destroyed a few traces ripping off the pots and things.
Okay. What was it?
Just one of the black envelope generators. So it was ADSR, had a loop and a trigger and an out. That was kind of it.
Oh, well, that's a shame.
Simple. It was cheap and cheerful, but I messed it up somewhere.
So you were saying they've stopped doing the DIY?
As far as I'm aware, where if you can still get them, it will just be old
residual stock
PCBs and people doing their own BOMs and stuff and chucking that.
I mean, it's the way of many manufacturers. They'll start as a DIY producer,
yeah,
and then once they've got a toehold, so to speak, they will move to full production and drop the DIY side of things.
Yeah, it's a cool little launching pad, I suppose, for smaller people. Yeah, so it looks like Thonk's still got some stuff. There's some sort of partial kits about.
I don't mind a partial kit. I've mostly got the rest of the stuff in stock anyway.
They might not have stock. If you go hide out of stock items, there's nothing Erica Synths on Thonk anymore.
It just vanishes.
Yeah.
I haven't looked on Thonk for ages.
Yeah. I do look quite often, even though I have nothing to do with it. Now, Luke, is it time for you to captain our spaceship? Is it time for Luke's Spacey Bit? Not my finest segue, I don't think. But what's happening in the spacey world?
You do yourself no credit. I enjoyed it. Well, today we have something that actually happened earlier today on the day we are recording this. This is hot off the press, the cutting edge of space news right now. NASA JPL flew their Mars helicopter prototype, which is named Ingenuity, for the first time on the 19th of April at something like 3:35 a.m. Eastern time, which I think is about 8:30 in the morning our time. But yeah, the Mars helicopter team at JPL published a live stream of the results of the flight as information came in from across the void of space from Mars. The reason why we had a live stream of the results and not the flight itself is because Mars is quite a long way away, even with information traveling at the speed of radio, you know, light, if you will, between the two places. It can take anywhere between 3 and 22 minutes for information to get to us, depending on how far away in its orbit Mars is from the Earth, because the Earth is traveling around the Sun slightly faster than Mars is, given that it's closer to the Sun. So they broadcast the download of information as it came through. In the stream, you can see the moment that the confirmation of the completion of the various stages of the flight were reported in. This goes from the takeoff, hover, landing, engine shutdown, all that stuff. And as that checklist is concluded, you can see the team start to celebrate and clap, and then more information starts to come through. You can see an image is sent back from the ventral camera on the craft, and you can see in this black and white photo the shadow of the craft as it hovers in midair, just resting in between the two tank tracks left behind by Perseverance as it drove over the drop-off location. So that was really cool. So yeah, the image that they sent back was from 3 meters up off the ground, where you can see the shadow of the craft underneath. The blades are frozen in the image due to the speed at which they rotate. You manage to get like a snap of them just perfectly still, which is quite cool. It does look very uncanny, though. It's quite an odd image to see. It took me a while to understand that what I was looking at was the shadow of the craft and not the craft itself. But I immediately thought, well, what would be photographing the helicopter from underneath? Nothing. And so, yes, they explain in the video that it's an image of the shadow of the craft from the craft itself. But of course, there is the pièce de résistance, the Perseverance rover itself sent back a color video of the small helicopter taking during its flight, which sent the JPL team quite bananas. The head of the project, Mimi Ng, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her surname quite correctly there, but she read out a speech congratulating the team and saying, on to more flights. It was quite emotional, actually. You could see her rip up what was obviously the failure speech written in advance. She had two copies. And she stood up, tore that in half to much applause, and then read out another speech in which she congratulated everybody for their hard work and success. Now, I just want to address the video that Perseverance sent back right out of the gate, because quite frankly, it looks like something that was made on Flash. It's not ideal, and I think it might be ripe for the conspiratorially minded among us. But important things to consider, the footage that we had from Perseverance's landing took a day or two to be processed, pardon me, properly, and edited into something watchable and understandable. We're dealing with data that's being sent across distances so vast, as we said, it takes anywhere between 3 and 20 minutes for that to actually bridge the gap. But this was the first transmission, and perhaps there were some glitches in the download or something. Specifically, the video doesn't show it actually rising. It's really uncanny. It shows the craft rotating its propellers on the ground, ready to apply power into the lift, and then it shows it kind of hovering and stuttering as though it's just a badly recorded video. And then it appears on the ground again. So there's no tracking of the craft. It's quite odd. But the scientists were very satisfied with that. So maybe there's more information to come. It could also be that this is the best quality footage we can allow from the Perseverance rover at this point. It's worth bearing in mind that the Ingenuity project, in terms of the wider Perseverance mission, is very much a nice to have. The processor, for example, is essentially a Snapdragon. It's the sort of thing that you get in a phone.
Oh, yeah. Smartphones and things.
Yeah. So it's not. It's an advanced version of one of those, probably with lots of overclocking, I imagine. But it's not built for the rough and tumble of the radioactive environment of space between the planets. It was one of those things where they built it, obviously spent a good deal of money researching and developing the craft, but it was always going to be a secondary objective. So Perseverance can't per se dedicate the full force of its imaging cameras to that project. Maybe, I hope that's not the case, because we do have 30 days for them to conduct more flight tests, and we're going to see more videos from those, one would presume. So maybe we'll get a better one coming. I would certainly like that to be the case, because it is a very monumental engineering feat that Ingenuity represents. It's the first time a rotorcraft, a propeller craft, has flown on another planet. So that's quite exciting. The video of the live stream of the results is really fun to watch. I would thoroughly recommend you check it out, because you can see the scientists talking through everything they're doing and why it's exciting. There's a point where the altimeter data comes through, and you can see the craft's journey, where the x-axis is altitude and the y-axis is time. You can see it rise to 3 meters and then drop back down again during the period of the hover. It's just really cool. It's just nice to see these very passionate and talented people seeing the fruits of their labor come through in real time, which was just really nice that they live streamed that. So I'm sure we'll get a bit more of that when Ingenuity flies again over the next 30 days.
Nice one. Do you know if they've got any other particular tests lined up? Have they said anything about that yet?
Yeah, so there is a flight schedule. I don't have it to hand, but it is where they're going to be conducting various flight tests. They're going to be going higher. There'll be some horizontal movement as well. The idea is that it will pave the way for bigger craft to be sent in the future that can perhaps actually be used to scout and so on.
Yeah, nice.
So is it mainly just proof of concept, or they actually do some hard science with it at all, or this particular version?
Yeah, so it's proof of concept that is providing science for them to do on in the future, basically. Yes, it's an engineering challenge that they didn't know if it was going to work. They did their best to test it, so they tested Ingenuity in a cold chamber that had a lot of the air pumped out. One of the challenges they had to face was that the density of Mars's atmosphere is only about 1% that of Earth. So
1%, really?
Yeah, it's very sparse there. So it's very challenging for a rotorcraft of any type to really get the lift that it needs. So it's extraordinarily light. The little thing measures something like 13, well, the body of the craft itself is 13 by 19 by 16 centimeters, give or take some change, not including the legs. That is, the wingspan of the rotors by comparison is 1.2 meters, so it's quite a bit bigger in terms of what the rotors are doing, quite a lot more work for a very, very small payload. And it weighs 1.8 kilograms at that size, the rotors being made of carbon fiber to reduce weight. So they test it in this cold chamber where they pump out all the air. They put it on a sort of a pulley, a kind of suspension cable to simulate the lack of gravity, and then they power it up from there. So they were reasonably confident that it would work, but they couldn't obviously account for wind. And again, there's not a lot of wind on Mars, but it is there, and obviously they were testing in a very safe environment. So it was a proof of concept craft, to answer your question properly, but it is also the sort of thing where it's going to give them a lot of data that they just can't get here on Earth.
So it's a bit like, was it Pathfinder, which was the first rover? The one that went in, I want to say, 97.
Mm. So the first thing of its kind. It's going to be particularly helpful for scientists working on Dragonfly, which you've mentioned previously on the show, which is a larger quadcopter craft that's going to be about as large as a Perseverance-style rover, you know, a small car. And they're hoping that will fly around Titan in the not-so-distant future.
Mm.
So that would be very cool.
Exciting stuff.
That about wraps up space news from me. One other honourable mention would be that NASA have selected SpaceX as the provider for the Artemis lunar landing craft, which is cool, but Starship is massive, and I'm a bit worried about them getting that down onto the lunar surface. Obviously, much smarter people than I have decided that Elon Musk's company can build this thing, but it's just very dubious. If that happens, if we live to see it, which I'm sure we will, that's going to be tremendous. But also, wow, I mean, what NASA accomplished in the 60s with the Apollo system is very different. It's tiny in comparison and extremely lightweight.
Imagine they've already got something, again, proof of concepts that they've demonstrated to win the contract. Won't we just have a few blueprints?
The idea is by the end of the decade, they will develop a lunar-capable version of the Starship craft.
Really?
Which is crazy, because I don't know if you've seen a lot of the videos out of Boca Chica, but it's still very much a prototype. They're building these things at an incredible rate. They've got, I think, something like nearly 20 of them in construction at any one time, which is crazy. But or rather, I think they're up to serial number 20 out of the ones that they're building, but they haven't flown any of that. I do remember reading that they are essentially building faster than they have the capacity or the allowance to test, based on the approval from the US flight agency. But at the same time, those things are incredibly impressive. And when a Starship finally does complete its test run, it will look like a Thunderbird. It's going to be a really cool day.
Yeah.
But I'm just so scared of that machine. It's enormous.
Is this contract they now have from NASA to build something more equivalent to the original Apollo lunar lander, but a sort of 21st century version of that?
As I understand it, it's just a lunar-capable Starship. That's all it
is. Okay, so it's not for the return to the moon, which is in theory 2025, unless that's slipped again.
It will be forming the landing portion of that mission. I think the Artemis roadmap is that they're going to return to the moon, certainly for a flyby with the Orion spacecraft, which is very similar to the Apollo command module. But in terms of anything that would be close to the Eagle lander, it looks like SpaceX are going to be the company that are delivering that, and it will be a Starship. So it's kind of like, well, why are they choosing them when they're going to be building a system that competes with the SLS that can take people to and from the moon, but also land them on the moon, and is, you know, therefore superior in some engineering respects to the SLS, where the SLS would launch a Apollo-style capsule rather than an entire rocket ship the size of the Starship. It is a bit of a strange one. We'll have to see what that means for SLS's future, given that that project is often criticized for its wastefulness. Now that NASA have said, hey, SpaceX are going to make the lander, it makes you wonder, well, then what's going in the SLS if it's just the Orion craft? It seems almost pointless. But then again, maybe not. I mean, the Orion craft will serve other purposes, and it will be docking with the space station they're going to build around the moon, the Gateway station, and all sorts of other things. The point is rather that the Starship will be forming part of the landing process. So who knows how that will shake out in the future. But it's exciting, and it's cool to see the SpaceX are doing well. But at the same time, yeah, Starships are crazy. They're huge and they're very scary. Yeah.
Starship's one of the reusable ones, right?
It is originally called the BFR. I'll let you figure that one out.
Yep.
And it is very much that. It's an enormous 50-meter rocket. It's just going to be very strange to see something like that take off from the moon. It's going to be going back to the original concept for NASA getting to the moon in the 50s and 60s was what they would call direct descent, where they would take your Thunderbirds type thing, put it on a big old booster, send it out there. The whole thing would land, the whole thing would take off and come back. And that's fine, but it takes a lot of fuel to get there and a lot of mass. And it brings up questions of, well, do we make fuel once we're there to bring it back? How do we take...
Yeah.
You end up rubbing up against the rocket equation really hard, where it's like, if you want to take a bigger craft further, you need more fuel. If you want to take more fuel further, you need more thrust and more fuel and more fuel and more fuel. And so, yeah, when fuel becomes payload, you've got some serious problems with efficiency. So we'll have to see what they do with that. But it's going to be interesting to see.
Yes, and gradually more and more it is slipping over to private enterprise. I mean, there was always an element of that somewhere in the background. There was contractors and so forth. But now it really is becoming much more orientated to that type of thing. I even read or heard recently, I don't know how accurate this is, that NASA were looking at having some sort of reality TV show.
Wow.
And the basis of that, it sounded like it'd be potentially members of the public sort of training in a competition fashion to become, to go into space, go to the International Space Station.
But kind of done like TOWIE.
Yeah. Or
Or
the Cardassians.
Oh, could you imagine? Honestly. I have to mention that complaint. I'm a big fan of NASA. You've all seen my NASA t-shirts, my NASA mug. I've been to the Kennedy Space Center, which was a life-fulfilling young boy's dream made real. But watching their live streams, not so much the JPL one today, there was a huge amount of it dismissing, which was just fantastic. But they're so tied up in this very strange, I don't know, it's like they're dumbing it down, which I think sounds awful because I want more people to be involved in space. I want more people to understand how space stuff works. So I don't mean that in a derogatory way, because obviously it is all very difficult to understand, and I barely grasp a huge amount of the large concepts, and it's a special interest of mine. The point is rather, it's got a very commercial and strange feel to it. I don't like the way the NASA live casts and media goes at the moment. There's not a huge amount of detail. It's all very focused on like emotional payout, which is fine, but I'd like some accuracy as well. And I'd also like someone to be asking questions like, how does that work? Rather than like, what does this mean for America? It's like, I don't care. I want to know how they did it. And I think everyone does. So I don't know. Maybe that will change, but I don't see it changing. It seems to be getting worse. But SpaceX, I think, are more my cup of tea, because their live streams tend to be, they just have the numbers at the bottom. There's a brief outline of what's going to happen, and then it happens. And then that's it.
Yeah.
But perhaps that's too much the other way, because they don't often divulge anything that goes wrong until months afterwards, partially because they have to figure it out first, but also I think because of this, that whole private company reputation thing.
Yeah, they don't need to, do they?
Yeah, and they have proprietary technology and information to keep secret, of course. Mm. So just one of those interesting things about the space race we have now. But that's it. We're in a new space race. It's very exciting. We are in the early 60s and the late 50s right now again. You know, they're building the big rockets that are going to go there, so that's quite cool to be able to see that in our near future.
Yeah, just looking at pictures of Starship, it's so evocative. Like you mentioned Thunderbirds, I'm on board. Yeah, it's definitely got that vibe about it.
When they get it going, it's going to be so cool. It's going to be that thing where, like, I imagine like the Saturn V was for people of yesteryear, that the Starship is going to be that thing that makes kids want to go to space. It's going to be so cool.
Ironic thing is Thunderbirds chronologically was set around about now.
Yeah.
Was it actually? Is it like the sort of the second millennium? Is that, or third millennium, whatever? Is that the kind of idea?
Yeah, because I can't remember who was the father. Was it Tracy on Tracy Island?
Tracy's a surname, isn't it?
Yeah. In the canon of Thunderbirds, he was the first man on Mars, wasn't he?
Wow. Okay, I don't remember.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I've been saying to my partner that we're going to sit down and watch those again, because we both have fond memories of the old marionette shows. We both had a couple of the compilations on VHS, but have since lost them. And I think I found them on not too dodgy of a website, listeners, if you want to watch them. And that would just add that nostalgia thing. We'll definitely go back to that.
It's Jeff, by the way. That's the dad.
Jeff Tracy.
I do remember when I was little and watching Thunderbirds at every available opportunity.
Of course.
I was like, oh, Ben, what a stupid name. I want to be called Virgil.
Yes. I decided that my name was Alan for a little bit after Thunderbird 3, I think, the one that goes into space. There you go.
I don't think I had a favourite. I like the equipment more than anything else.
Mm.
Just a quick question. Favourite episode?
Ooh, I don't know what any of the titles, but there was one with some giant walking thing called the Sidewinder.
Yeah.
And it sort of crashed into that was my favourite.
It fell into a pit of explosives.
Probably, something like that.
Yeah, that one I was I really liked that one. There was another one, another great beastie machine that was kind of not very ecologically ripping through the jungle and laying a motorway behind it.
Oh, yes, that one was good. I think my favourite, I can't remember the title of it either, but it was the one where they followed the guy doing the mining on the mountain, like Harry Hauser or something, and he was his mining machine. That, like, I love the close-up handwork they used to do, where they had like the actual like water and the environment dripping over the guy's fingers as it was raining and all sorts. And he was putting mining charges into the side of a cliff face, and it all went horribly wrong, and they had to go and rescue him. That was a great episode. I enjoyed that one. Just the mood of it. It's all done, I think, in like twilight with rain and thunder and lightning and all sorts.
We're rambling, but we can use that as a, from the three of us, a miscellaneous multimedia recommendation.
By all means.
Just get stuck in on your Thunderbirds. Why not? Captain Scarlet, Stingray, all of those lovely ones. But for the official recommendation of Ben from Rec Addicts After Hours for the multimedia, whatever, it's going to be a musical one. Because I'm trying to get out of YouTube, because I think it's probably an addiction at this point. A band... There's one song for you to listen to from a band called Thank You Scientist. The song is apparently pronounced Fox Mulder, but it's just FXMLDR. It's about an 8-minute tune. It is prog rock, jazz, some sort of funk in there. There's definitely a brass section. I'm pretty sure there's some strings. It's interesting. It's quite a melting pot. There's vocals too. If you actually also take a listen to Feed the Horses, that's Thank You Scientist as well. That's an earlier tune. And between the two, not only is there a slight increase in the production quality, which is kind of to be expected, but you can really sense a maturing of their styles, because they're really trying to squish a bunch of stuff together. And it was on the border of working quite well at the Feed the Horses around about that time. But this new stuff, Fox Mulder, is really, really great, quite listenable, really interesting. Yeah, Thank You Scientist, if you can't decide what genre you want to listen to. Who's next?
I can go if you like. I also have a music recommendation. This is an artist I've been keeping an eye on for a little while, since I heard her single, Black Dog, some time ago. It's a song that I would thoroughly recommend people listen to off of their new album, Collapsed in Sunbeams. The artist is Arlo Parks. Black Dog is quite a somber tune. Fair word of warning to anybody. It is about depression, it is about suicide, but it's a beautiful song, and the lyrics are just very plain spoken and exceptionally relatable. It's a really tender song, and the album follows suit in that manner. It is Collapsed in Sunbeams by Arlo Parks. The mood of it actually really reminds me of a thing we used to do in Birdsworth back before there was a pandemic, called Sofa Sounds. That's S-O-F-A-R Sounds. It's a service where they actually put some of their recordings up on YouTube, but the main body of it is a traveling gig promotion company where they will essentially have a member or a participant volunteer their office space, flat, house, whatever, generally speaking in London, and they'll put on an impromptu sit-down gig there, just in a living room or something like that, hence the term Sofa Sounds. The idea is that it's intimate, no talking, the idea is the artist can talk a bit more about their thing than they can do at live gigs or at electric gigs anyway. It's just the idea is just to get intimate music out there, and it just reminds me very much of that time, because you'd get all sorts of kinds of music. You'd get artists doing poetry, you get artists doing music, and Arlo Parks' new record just reminds me of that time when we were doing a few of those concerts and some of the great artists that we watched and met there at those things. So yeah, that would be my recommendation.
Nice one. It's Pete's turn.
Right, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do anything for your YouTube addiction. I'm just going to make it worse.
No.
But you will like this one. And again, it's another one of these channels whereby you can witness people doing things exceptionally well.
Ooh, nice.
CNA is a news channel out of Singapore, which it's quite interesting to have news from a perspective from another country in itself. It's different. But they have been running a series called Remarkable Living Artisans.
Yep, that sounds absolutely perfect.
And it's sort of a small series, and you've got to pick through all the other stuff, because they post a lot of videos, because it's a 7x24 news channel. The usual sort of stuff, lots of vaccine pandemic stuff going on. They do a certain amount of bits and pieces that covers global news in the respect of USA, Russia, Europe, UK, etc. But most of the focus is entirely centered around their area of the globe, so to speak. So they cover a lot of Singapore, Japan, parts of China, that type of thing. So it's very...
This is no good, Pete. I've already added like 3 to my Watch Later playlist. This is... No. Stop.
However, this series of these artisans is featuring craftsmen. Some of them are elsewhere. There was a guy in London who made globes, very expensive globes. Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned it previously. The one of them on there, I think the deposit was something like £10,000. That was just the deposit for the globe. There was one I was looking at earlier, and it was one of these specialist knife makers in Japan.
Yeah, one I added was Japanese watchmaker makes one watch a year.
And again, not very long videos, 5 or 6 minutes or so, generally covering some very skilled craftsman, artisan. As usual, not too taxing, just something that you can distract yourself with for a few minutes. So that is...
Perfect.
As I scroll back, CNA. And that's it.
YouTube. Lovely stuff. Actually, I'm just looking at the top of the thing. I just searched Remarkable Living. 111 videos in that playlist. There's a lot of back catalogue to chew on. Nice one. Well, thank you, dear audience. If you made it this far into the podcast, you're very patient. And thank you for enjoying to our voices. We love making these for you, and we hope you stick around. We'll catch you in the next one. Stay safe. Farewell.